go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. You can simply go to Amazon.com, search The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find the second edition there, as well as the Kindle version as well. Welcome, everybody, to The Cognitive Rampage. Hope you got that intro still. I do really miss saying welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast when it starts. I miss doing that, but we got those plugged in intros in there. I'm excited today, a little fearful of the guest that's on today, only just pointing out the awareness of my own anticipation when I talk to people that are smarter than me, have done more than me, have quite the experience in life. And I guess I just get excited to learn. So I'd say 12 years is what they're saying at the top end extreme skier in the world. I can't imagine I'll probably share my two skiing stories like everyone probably has done with her that she's tired of hearing. But Kristen Ulmer has basically stood at what you would call the precipice of fear as you tend to drop down a mountain and fall and die. And facing that for that many years and experiencing what that's like competing as well, brings up all of those cortisol levels and gets our adrenaline pumping and makes you really face fear. And after all those years, she has decided to compile and do us all a favor and write us a book called The Art of Fear and tell us why we need to basically go at the fears, what I'm picking up from it. But Kristen, thank you for coming on The Cognitive Rampage.
Very excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I was excited when Stephen Kotler shared your book. I saw it and I said, yeah, I'm going to have to know that and I'm going to have to learn and get into it, because fear is a topic. I think it can be so subjective in a way, but so humanly responsive. And it tends to be a topic that you see a lot of people discussing, whether it's societal fear, culture fear, fear of the world or health or cancers and EMF, right? We get a lot of that and we face it on different levels.
Well, a lot of people like to talk about fear, but I don't think many people know what to do about it. In fact, since I wrote the book, my husband and I Googled it because I am kind of a fear specialist, right? I'm apparently the only fear specialist in the world. Isn't that crazy?
Well, I guess the only one in the world, yes, I would say, but given the resume of being a fear specialist, I'm not sure too many people want to compile that resume of experience to say that they're a fear specialist, you know?
Everybody has an opinion about fear, and there are a lot of anxiety specialists, which I don't think people really realize that anxiety and fear are the same thing, although anxiety is undealt with fear. But yeah, when it comes to fear, there's scientists studying it in a laboratory, you know, what happens in the brain and the system with the release of adrenaline and all that. But that doesn't really make them a specialist. And There's also psychologists that give people opinions on what to do about panic attacks. There's self-help gurus. Some of them have even written books about fear, but they wouldn't actually just go ahead and declare themselves a fear specialist. They move on to other things. And I just don't think that many people know what kind of advice to give about fear, except for, oh, we need to lessen it. You know, it's a bad thing, right? Let's now get to work trying to get rid of it.
Yeah, you do. It's the uncovering, right? Anxiety is, being a mental health counselor myself and approaching people, a lot of people do take the approach of, let's make it disappear. Let's cover it up. Let's act like it doesn't exist. And when it seems to be this biological evolutionary response of ours of something to try to, blanket that or quiet that seems kind of, you know, backwards. When, I work with a lot of MMA fighters as well. And one of them in particular, I won't use his name, but, mainly I don't want to give his game away or things that he talks about or worries about, but he has bad fight anxiety pre-fight, which can do a lot of things biologically, release a lot of stuff. And he keeps saying, help me not be afraid. And I kind of go, well, why? You'll die. You know what I mean? You can't do that. Is this kind of the angle that you were writing about? And I'd like to get more into it about, is this kind of the approach?
Well, yes. First of all, of course he's going to be afraid. He's trying to do big things with his life. Anybody that's trying to do big things with their lives is going to be afraid. But there's kind of two questions to ask ourselves when this fear or this anxiety shows up. Is this a sign of personal weakness? Or is this a sign that this is just a natural, organic part of the human experience? And I think that we've gotten used to seeing this as a personal weakness. Like something has gone wrong when fear shows up, not that something's gone right. And now, next thing you know, like there's a situation that's causing the fear, like the fight or I'm about to give a speech or something like that. But then there's the fear that shows up and we've actually made the fear the bigger issue than the situation, like the fight or the speech. Mostly because we just think that there's something wrong with us. Like it's something to be embarrassed about. And our friends and family and coaches support this belief, like, hey, there's nothing to be afraid of. It's just in your imagination. It sends a message. I call it fear shaming, that there's something wrong with you.
Oh, yes, just what you hear, right? I mean, look at the eras of the no fear brand, right? It was no fear brands and I'm not afraid of anything. And we're even supposed to come up and not be afraid, right? But as if we're not supposed to cry either, right? These same natural emotional responses. You're right. It's definitely looked at as a weakness.
I did the same thing in my ski career. As you mentioned, I was the best woman big mountain extreme skier in the world for 12 years. And I was dealing with a lot of fear. I mean, I wasn't just fear of like looking like a fool in the cameras, but I had the fear of death. Like sometimes every single turn I took, if I made the wrong decision, I would die. You know, I don't think people understand how dangerous these sports are. And so I took the advice of what you hear out there, which is I need to conquer, overcome fear, let it go, think positive thoughts. And I did that, and I did it so well. I think I was more famous for my ability to control and repress fear than I was even for the skiing itself. And so I looked on the outside like I was the poster child for fearlessness and what you should be doing with regard to fear. But it turns out I wasn't. And
what a humble revelation to come to, right? When you're in that moment, you go, wait, I've been doing it wrong the whole time. I'm in my mind. Take me there, Kristen. The first time you decide to do the out of the helicopter type thing, the first time maybe when you're going up there, maybe you haven't tried, what are they, the black diamonds or something like that, or you're crazy as heck is what they should call them. But walk me through like that first time, that first go for you.
The first time I jumped off a cliff, I had never jumped off a cliff before, and I picked about a 25-foot cliff, and I threw a back scratcher, which I had never done before, and I just didn't feel any fear. I felt kind of more like just a businessman at work just doing their thing, you know? And it turns out I was just a natural at repressing fear. And I think if we want to back up, I started not dealing with my fear at about age 6. You know, I had parents that had a bad marriage. We don't need to get into that. It's interesting. It's in the book. But I also was on the U.S. ski team, and I never had any goal to get on the U.S. ski team. I was just trying to do road trips with friends. And next thing you know, I'm wearing the jacket. There's thousands of people watching me. I'm on the team. I'm representing my country. There's cameras in my face. And I'm like pickled in fear. It's like, what do I do? And so course, well-meaning coaches all said, well, you need to put that out of your mind. You need to visualize your success, all that. And so I kind of learned it from mogul skiing and from my childhood. And by the time I got to jumping off that cliff, you know, I was well on the path to looking like I was dealing with fear the right way. But actually, I learned 10 years later that it was not the right way to handle fear.
It makes me think how good you could have been those early 10 years applying this fear. If you were already the best in the world for 12 years, what do you conquer if you actually realize you're doing it the right way and apply those methods? You skipped over kind of the childhood, and being the counselor I am, I couldn't help but want to go, well, wait. So I think it's influential what we come up in. I mean, I wrote about my abusive childhood as well in my book. And as you skipped over, I think it's influential, right? The first time we face a fear, right? When I don't know the extent of it, or if you'd even share that. But, you know, for me as a child, right, the father became the monster, right? The person I was scared of, right, that came into the room. And I mean, that was my first taste of fear, you know, that I can remember at that age. It wasn't being bullied or in a fight or football or any of those other sports I played. It was that. And so for you, as you kind of skipped over it, it made me kind of want to know a little bit more about that maybe helped shape how you began to suppress fear, continued to. And then I'd like to also maybe walk into what woke you up to this later.
Okay. Well, when we are young, of course, when we first feel the discomfort of fear, fear is a uncomfortable sensation in your body. We think it's in our minds, but maybe we'll get to that later. I hope we do, because that's an important point. But the second we feel that discomfort in our body, us humans have a long history of avoiding anything uncomfortable. And it's also supported by our friends, family, teachers, society, et cetera, that, you know, when we feel sadness, oh, well, turn that frown upside down. When we feel fear, mom says, well, there's nothing to be afraid of. When we feel anger, well, we don't do that in our family. Like we're taught to avoid the discomfort. And so I was no different. And you know, I was a free range child, and I just realized that if I was going to have to raise myself, then I was going to have to put this discomfort out of my mind and get tough and strong. And it was a pathology and a demon that, of course, ultimately led to me being a great athlete. Like I definitely had kind of the right, it seems like the right approach to fear to begin with. But going back to what you originally started talking about, is that if somebody had handed me my book when I was a child and said, okay, you know, the repression of fear got you to this point, like it kind of works, but it can only take you so far. But if now you make friends with fear and kind of not live a lie about the fact that you have this, these uncomfortable feelings, and then maybe you can even use the fear as a tool to perform better, be more creative, be more present, be more focused, I would have been a lot better an athlete, and I wouldn't have had so many long-term repercussions that I then had to spend a decade recovering from.
So I think when we do face that fear as young kids, whatever that influence was to you that shaped you, was like for me, the football was my escape when I was younger, martial arts, but the sports were my escape. The weight room was my escape, right? To almost kind of hide the fear better, right? I could, a lot of times I was called conceited around, but it was me trying to just act like I was better than I was feeling inside and what I was being around. Was skiing like that for you? Because I know you started at a really young age and didn't have much coaching really, just naturally went into it. Do you think that maybe some of that fear or what you went through was part of that ingredient to self-motivate and push yourself to excel so well?
Well, I had a couple things going on during my ski career. And the one thing was that I loved feeling fear. Did I know that? No, I know that now. You know, we call them adrenaline addicts, when really beneath the adrenaline is fear. And so on the one hand, I was so drawn to fear, like a heroin addict is drawn to heroin, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I had that going on. And then I was also repressing it. So I had kind of a paradox going on. And when you make your life all about one thing, you know, can you love it and hate it at the same time? Absolutely. So I had a love affair with fear, and I also hated it to the extreme and repressed it. And you know, I have this list that I want to kind of introduce right now, and I have it here. I'm going to read from it though, because I don't know if you can.
Yeah, we can see it.
But how to know if you're repressing your emotions. And you say that you are drawn to football. You know, in many ways, that's you being drawn to fear. Like anytime you try to do something that is, you know, exciting, right? There's going to be fear. Like, will I get hurt? Will I look like a hero? Will I be a fool? Will I, you know, disappoint my whole team? Like, you're going to feel fear. So you're both drawn to it, but then you are also probably repressing it.
Wow, you're tripping me out. You're not even the psychologist. You're tripping me out right now. I mean, because after my football career was over, I got bad. I mean, I was drug dealer, robbing drug dealer. I was a bad, bad man for a couple of years when I was no longer the football player. But it excited me, right? The possibility of being shot or something like I was. Yes, it was a pull to it, man. Yes,
yeah, right. So you are drawn. It's like some people are really drawn to fear, and other people aren't drawn to fear. And so, yes, that's, you know, you replaced.
Why? Why does that happen?
Yeah. Well, because we want to expand who we are. We want to be alive. Like I've probably asked 500 people now, if given the choice between feeling happy or feeling alive, which would you prefer? You have to pick one. And 499 picked alive.
Wow. Okay.
Now, happy is so overrated. Like, we want to feel alive. And I'll tell you what. The things that make you feel alive, if you think back on your life, the times that you most felt alive, for sure, fear was part of the equation. You know, the time that you were mugged even, the time that you were at a rally and the cops were there and, you know, you might get arrested or the dealing drugs or, for me, jumping off cliffs. And so we're drawn to it. It's such a key ingredient in aliveness. I call it the single drop of blood in the shark tank.
It is. Well, I'm also a spear fisherman, extreme fear specialist. I can't even talk right now. Spear fisherman. I got deep into the primal stuff, man. I had a run in with a saltwater crocodile fairly up close, and I was waiting and fishing. But in that moment when it's like 2 feet from me looking at me and it goes under, I was like, okay. You know, it was that moment of like what happens and nothing happens. But after that, I started a whole company called Primal Nature. I was taking people on these crazy primal adventures. So you're right. It's drawn to it. I'm getting excited because you're touching right on exactly what I experienced and putting it in a different context. So it's new for me, if you will.
Yeah. What is it that we're drawn to? Well, make no mistake. What you're drawn to is fear. And then, of course, we then feel the fear.
But then you try to suppress it.
So it's kind of like this contradiction. Like, it's a paradox, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's why I'm sitting here going, wait a minute. Then I conquer the fear. Then I don't want to feel afraid. And then I try to feel afraid. And then I'm chasing the afraid. And then you wonder why nothing changes over so many years. And I dig this, Kristen. Continue. I'm sorry.
No problem. So going back to the list, some people avoid fear. Like, they don't really want to deal with it. They don't want to feel it. They don't do scary things at all with their life. They get a really safe job. You know, one of the primary causes of burnout in your work is not enough fear, you know? Isn't that interesting?
I guess if you're right, if you're just staring at your computer playing Office Space all day and there's nothing there, that we don't have that struggle, right? That primal struggle or the thing to push us to want to move and try. Yeah. Wow.
But one of the other causes of burnout is the opposite, is that you have a lot of fear in your career and you're repressing it in order to do it. And it just takes so much energy to push the fear down and not deal with it and fight that war with this primary core part of us, you know, this discomfort that is with us, you know, anytime we're trying to do something big. We become exhausted by trying to repress that. And that also burns us out. So that's two ways that you can be burnt out at work. And, you know, going back to my list, you know, how to know if you're repressing your emotions, because we're kind of jumping ahead of ourselves. Like, we're getting to all the good stuff about fear, but really we got to talk about the consequences of repressing it, which most of us do. So some of the things that we do to repress our emotions, this is called how to know if you're repressing your emotions. You watch a lot of tea. TV, watch a lot of TV. You eat a lot. You smile a lot. You, get silly. Like, you take on a comedian persona. You get really busy. Like, people that are super busy, they're not dealing with their fear. You overanalyze fear. Like, you're always thinking about fear. You're trying to rationalize it away. You're super analytical. You're maybe really, really heady intellectualizing. That's another way to not deal with your emotions.
Okay. All right. What am I afraid of now? You're listing, if those are my traits, I think you'd be listing my personality traits right now, Kristen. I'm starting to ask
you're not dealing with your fear.
Right, I'm asking myself what am I afraid of right now? What am I afraid of? But no, yeah, keep going. Sorry.
So you and I have what sounds like to be a very similar relationship with fear. Well, I have a new relationship with fear. I wrote this book. I've spent 15 years kind of shifting in my relationship with fear. But we have the same relationship that I had back in my ski career, both where you're really drawn to it, but you're also repressing it at the same time.
Well, because when I had chased it, I was in shootouts. You know what I mean? So when I was chasing what I was doing, what I felt was left. Then when I left that, it was the nightclub business. So for me, every choice that followed in chasing the fear put myself in some messed up situations and really put me in bad places. So I began not to trust the fear that led me not to start trusting myself almost to where you learn to go, okay, that's what I want to do. Do the opposite. That's what you start to think about. Perhaps the suppression is somewhere in that.
So we'll talk more about suppression in just a moment, but let's just kind of back up and look at the big picture here. I don't think that people really get how much of a role fear plays in their lives. Like, whether we're aware of it or not, it's under the surface of every single moment of every single interaction and every single choice that we make. And we don't have an honest, clear relationship with fear. I say that your relationship with fear is the most important relationship of your life because it's the relationship that you have with your core self. And one of the last sentences of my book is about 7% the story of my relationship with fear. And I say that the story of your relationship with fear is the story of your life. Like, that's how big of a deal fear is. You know, what is your relationship with fear? And that just defines every single moment of your life, every decision that you make, the way that you act, whether you repress it or you chase after it or all of that. And if we're repressing fear, if we're not dealing with our fear, we're not kind of really dealing with our issues. We're not dealing with our shadow. You know about shadow, of course. We're not really fully living. We're not really fully coming alive. If we're running from fear, we're running from life. If we're trying to control fear, we're trying to control life. We're trying to control, might as well try to control the sun, the moon, and the stars while you're at it, right? And your life can become all about that one thing. Like, the point is that your relationship with fear is the most important relationship of your life. So we might as well make it a conscious one.
Yeah, I would agree. I've been known to get emails after I say it on a podcast or two, but it doesn't sound as romantic. But I even say that I do say that fear is the motivator to just about everything we do, if not everything. I even say that people fall in fear, not in love. Many times that we meet someone that shares the same fears that we do in life and we connect in those fears. Thus, then we call it love because it sounds better. But then that person understands us. They share our fears. When you begin to list what in love means, it basically begins to sound like this person understands my fear.
Well, and when I actually have a big bit in the book about that, like, fear and vulnerability are so intimately tied. And of course, when you fall in love, you are also kind of going belly up and being vulnerable. And it's like that fear, like, will he or won't he, right? Is this going to work out or isn't it? Like, love without a drop of fear is not nearly as exciting. And there's no vulnerability there either. So without fear, the whole love experience wouldn't be much of anything.
And then imagine trying to suppress the fear that you may share with someone or suppress the love, right? It could be that similar idea when you just love someone that way, right? You try to suppress and act like you don't love them, right? It could be that same hard thing to fight, right? If you're trying to act like you don't want to be with somebody or suppress a loving feeling that you may have for other certain reasons, maybe as hard as it is, right, to suppress fear. Like you said, it's in all parts of our lives and it's a part of our lives and really suppressing the main ingredient, I guess, to our choices.
And if you're not dealing with your fear in an honest way, then you're going to be projecting it on your partner. Next thing you know, you're going to be like a monkey throwing your shit at them. You know, like, I'm not going to be, can I say that on this? You know, can I swear?
Yeah.
crap, throwing your crap, right? Like, I'm not dealing with my fear, so I'm just going to put it on you. And, you know, I say in relationships that if you're not dealing with your fear, like, let's say you leave your clothes laying around all over the house, somebody has to pick them up for you. Like, if you're not dealing with your fear, somebody else has to deal with it on your behalf. And the classic example is like the super laid back husband and the super over anxious wife. And the more laid back he becomes, the more anxious she becomes, because she's not only dealing with her own fear, but she's also dealing with his fear, because somebody has to be the responsible person in life, right? Like your relationship with fear just dramatically affects your love relationships, the relationships you have with your children. If you're trying to control your fear, you try to control theirs as well. You try to control them as people. Like,
what about the love for self? What about the love for ourselves that we damage by doing so and not handling it or dealing with the fear?
Yeah, I liken fear to like a child, right? So let's say that fear is a child, and let's say there's a child over here called gratitude, love, joy. You know, we love and nurture and show off to the world these children. And then we have these children over here like fear, sadness, anger. You know, what we tend to do is put them in the basement, lock the door, and throw away the key. And, oh, but look at these wonderful children that I'm showing off to the world, and I'm nurturing and cultivating. Like, having a gratitude practice right now is really popular in America. So what happens to this child that's now shoved down in the basement? First of all, they're really upset. Maybe they're very sad. And whatever fear feels from the basement, you now feel. And so all of a sudden we see the cause of depression. You know, if fear, like depression is Latin for pressed down. Like, if we're pressing down our fear, that's kind of, well, not dealing with your fear is the cause of actually depression. And then we take medication so that we put fear 10 feet below the basement, encased in cement, so that we really don't have to deal with fear. I'm telling you, people devote their lives to not dealing with their fear.
You hit it with the depression, Kristen. You hit it with, I mean, that depression, these become symptoms. I write in my book about these depressions. We deal with depression, but these are symptoms of what's really occurring to the person, and to treat the person, not the symptoms. And beneath the pain, all of these things, it's hurt and fear is beneath, I would say, most of depression and anxiety is really hurt and fear. You are really talking about the root of many, many mental health disturbances.
Right. That's the cause.
Right.
You know, and we treat, like you said, perfect way of putting it. Like, we only treat the symptoms, which is the symptoms of repressed fear is depression or angst or anxiety or panic attacks or insomnia or monkey mind, like underperforming. And so what we do to treat them is we try to repress fear even further down in the basement, like take pills to get rid of it, which, I mean, the treatment or the symptom relief is actually the cause of these problems. It's crazy. And no wonder all these pills and all these modalities haven't lessened our anxiety, you know? So
you were talking to them. Keep on preaching that chemical incarceration. Thank you very
right.
much.
So here's this child called Fear. I like to personify Fear as being an individual. And we're talking to this individual like, I hate you. I'm embarrassed by you. Like, I want you to go away. I want nothing to do with you. I'm going to rationalize you away. You're just false evidence appearing real, whatever. Lock it in the basement. Well, how would anybody feel if you talked to him that way? Now fear's angry. Like, 95% of what we know is modern anger is nothing more than undealt with fear in the basement, right? So whatever fear feels, and fear may at this point even have a self-esteem issue, like it doesn't even know the value of itself. And so too, then you have a self-esteem issue. Like, if you have a problem in your life, either the repression or unwillingness to deal with fear has everything to do with it, or it has something to do with it, even if it's injuries, health issues, you name it.
Yeah, I talk about purging, right? Getting the hurt out. I talk a lot about anger sometimes. And underneath all of that, the resentments, the expectations, assumptions, we have fear right at the root of that. And usually beneath that fear is a hurt, or afraid to be hurt, or have been hurt before. And we suppress the idea of being hurt, right? Because we're not allowed to be hurt either. We can't be afraid and we can't be hurt. And so when we can't do those, we start having assumptions for ourselves. We set expectations for ourselves. We begin to resent ourselves and others. And then all we do is peacock. Now all we're doing is walk around going, I am angry, and dealing with this surface, because we're allowed to be mad and angry, right? We're allowed to be tough and pissed off. You're not allowed to be hurt and afraid.
Right. And I think of the kid that's very afraid. He's growing up, his life sucks, like his parents are not getting along. There's something wrong in his life. Really beneath the surface is fear. But in order to not deal with his fear, it feels a lot more powerful to be angry. Yeah. You know, there's no power in feeling sad or afraid, right? But there's power in feeling angry. And so when you see a kid that's really, really angry, that's just an overcompensation tool to not deal with his fear and sadness. Yeah. And but here's the thing. This is a major turning point in our conversation. We blame fear for being the problem, when really we should be blaming ourselves because we're not dealing with our fear. Mm. We're resisting our fear. It's our misguided reaction to the fear that is actually the problem, not the fear itself.
So the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Well, it used to be that fear comes from the amygdala, the lizard brain, sends a shot of discomfort to the body, said to lead to fight or flight, right?
Yeah. Walk me through the science part of it, what you've kind of encountered over the 15 years of writing the book. What is science saying about the fear response?
Well, it's not that science is saying this. And it's not even that psychologists are saying this. This is what I say. Right? Yeah. So this is what I came up with on my own. But we have animals, like they have a really simple, honest relationship with their fear. They don't think, what's the big deal? It's just rustling in the bushes, like get over it, right? What's wrong with me? I shouldn't feel so afraid, right? They're not embarrassed by their fear, right? They have an honest relationship with it. So amygdala sends a shot of discomfort to the body, propelling fight or flight, like run away from the car, or like the mama bear standing up protecting her cub. You know, she looks angry, but really she's afraid. You know, you're going to hurt her. That's fight, you know, flight, we know that. And so it leads to immediate physical action, motion, right? But humans, of course, are not animals. We're a lot more complicated. And so we have the same process, but there's a whole extra step involved. So the amygdala, perceived threat, sends a shot of discomfort to the body, that is fear. And then, and we're taught to do this, we start thinking about it. We start thinking about the emotion and we judge it. You know, we're very judgmental, good, bad, right, wrong, tall, short. It's how we're able to process a lot of information.
We are our own worst critic for sure.
Yeah. Right. And so we see it as bad, and then we start to control it and try to conquer it. We either run away from the fear. So now actually we're fighting or fleeing the fear itself rather than the situation. We're fleeing the fear or we're fighting the fear. And that's why all the language around fear says that words like we want to conquer or overcome it or don't let it get the better of us. Even the term face your fear, you know, it suggests, okay, face it and take out a sword or punch it in the face, you know, like screw you fear. You know, I'm going to face you. I'm not afraid of you. Right. Like it still has a combative nature. So we then declare war on fear,
right?
Push it down because that's all we know how to do. That's the only way that we know how to control it and get rid of it. It gets stored in our body. We now have an unwinnable war being carried out in our unconscious world that we started, you know, against this primary part of us that is going to covertly sabotage our whole lives and tax all our resources. And fear, which will not be denied, will now show up in a covert, pathological, weird, twisted, crazy way that the second your guard is dropped in the middle of the night will wake you up and run its agenda. And it's just such a bad idea. So we have this extra step, the thinking mind, and then the action is fight or fleeing the fear itself. And that's what's gone wrong.
Yeah, that's what's happening. So that's how people address it, right? So the fear happens, you get the shot or the hit. You know what's funny? Those are the animals that wind up dead, the ones that don't. You know, that's who's eaten first. And perhaps if we look at a general view of society and we said those that are suppressing the fear, well, they get eaten first and eaten up by the society, eaten by culture, eaten by depression, eaten by even body misfunction, right? I mean, when we're using our body and our energy spouting off whenever it wants to, when we have panic or fear, anxiety, then it's doing damage to us biologically. But you're right, right? We're taught to sit there and go, I love the idea of facing the fear. So far we've done everything, but we've ignored it. We've created a cognitive dissonance to fight it, or now we're fighting it. Now we're going to face it, right? Like you said. So these are all the things that people say, right? Now, what's wrong with that? And what else do we do?
Well, imagine Bambi. You know, there's some rustling in the bushes, right? Shot of fear to the body. And then Bambi says, oh, well, you know, is this irrational fear or is it rational fear? Is it good fear or is it bad fear? Like, what's going on with this fear? I don't like the way it feels, you know, dead, right?
Right.
And again, we're not animals, though. We're humans. And so we are going to think about it and we are naturally going to resist it. So suffering equals discomfort times resistance is the equation I have in the book. Another equation we can use is anxiety equals fear times resistance. Mm. Now, we all know that discomfort is a natural part of life. We're going to feel uncomfortable in our lifetime, sadness, anger, fear. Fear is natural, right? Like, we're going to feel fear. It's with us every moment of every single day. We could spend a moment right now figuring out where it is. Like, I feel it in my solar plexus, kind of in my throat right now. And that's natural, normal. And we can either get to work trying to reduce the fear, but it's not going to work. You're just going to repress it and it's going to wind up becoming your repressor. You know, whatever you try to control winds up controlling you. Much easier is to lower the resistance. So let's say your discomfort is level 10 and your resistance is a level 10. Our equation, suffering equals discomfort times resistance. 10 times 10 equals 100. That's a lot of suffering. Now, let's say your discomfort is a level 10. I'm about to give a speech or I'm about to do a job interview and I'm slightly underqualified, right? Level 10. But our resistance to the fear is only a 2. What's 10 times 2? A lot less suffering. So what I suggest is that people work on lowering their resistance to that sensation of discomfort. Like, how can I find a way to recognize, first of all, it's perfectly natural for me to feel this discomfort. It's not a sign of personal weakness. It's a natural part of the process of expanding who I am too. And that's the first step, is recognizing that it's natural. And then being curious about it. We can go over the steps more, but for now, just know that it's natural and that it's my resistance to the fear that is causing me the bigger problem in my life than the fear itself.
Yeah, rather than just face it, it's kind of a form of kind of an exposure therapy. If you're afraid of a snake, hold a snake. If you're afraid of a bridge, drive across one. Elevators, get in one. You know, really face it and not face it. Maybe experience it is a better word, because face it, like you said, now that you've said that, I'm never going to be able to say that again. To face the fear, because right. That just means square off with it and go to war with it, as opposed to experience the fear. Maybe it's kind of what I'm picking up from you is allow it in, experience the fear, and somehow use that fear.
Yeah. And even think about that, like back to the analogy of the child, like I'm going to face you and I'm going to use you to run my agenda, right? Like even that is a little disrespectful. So we want to be as respectful to fear as we can possibly be. And so the question is, how would a good parent a child, or how would a good maybe CEO make the best use of one of their colleagues or one of their employees? You know, I see fear as an employee, as a child, maybe as a friend.
Is it a tool we could use? Is it something in our toolbox or something?
Right. And that's why I love to personify fear. Like, how can I have the best relationship? Maybe a roommate. Like, how can I have the best relationship with this natural part of my life, you know, who's going to be my roommate my whole life? And you turn to it and you, first of all, you apologize, like, hey, I'm so sorry I've locked you in the basement for the last 40 years, right? With no food, no water, no love, no sunshine, right? I'm so sorry. And with any relationship, just notice how immediately that relationship starts to heal. And then think about what fear wants. What does anybody want? We all want to be loved and considered and listened to. Can you love, consider, listen to your fear? Can you have that kind of relationship with fear? Because if you have that kind of considerate relationship with fear, then you have the same relationship with yourself. So back to fear, of course, your relationship with fear is the most important relationship of your life. Let's try to make it the best possible relationship.
What are something, you know, as we utilize it, I'm trying to imagine myself, right, thinking about something I may be, or, you know, I'm about to take another drive across the country. You know, I just packed up all my stuff one day and me and my dog and drove across the United States. And I'm about to do the same thing here in about a week or so. And of course, right, you have a little bit of fear of traveling, right? What if I break down? I'm driving along the Mexican border, right? I got issues. So I'm imagining myself sitting there and trying to think about how would I would approach this fear. And I was also had a thought as if how you approach the mountain on an Olympic run or something hard that you did. I can't imagine anything being easy, but something difficult that you did. What was your approach when you did the old way versus how you may approach that mountain nowadays? If you go back knowing what you know now, right, and go down the and go down the black triple diamond, you're crazy thing. If you can do that now, what how would you approach that differently?
Well, let's start with you and your road trip, right?
Okay.
So fear is here to remind you not to forget to pack anything. Like, okay, you know, I'm not going to be able to come back. I'm going to Mexico. Like, don't forget to bring your passport. Like, it's here to kind of heighten our senses and make us not forget things, right? And then once you embark on the journey, then if you listen to fear, if you heeded the message of fear, then you won't have forgotten anything. Like it's a very, very wise voice. And really, if you are able to tap into fear, you tap into intuition, instinct, all of that. You know, if you don't have a healthy relationship with fear, you forget things, you don't tap into your intuition and instinct. And so now I'll transition to standing at the top of a mountain, right? And I'm about to film a movie and it's 55 degrees and it might avalanche and I'm going to jump off a cliff before and they're filming from the helicopter and it's $50, right? Like it's an intense situation. What I used to do is I would rationalize the fear away by saying, I got this. I would become really tough and stoic and rigid and just kind of monotone. Stoic is the word. And that would be a way that I would block it out. But notice now the amount of tension that I have to hold to not deal with fear. And what do we know about trees that are rigid in a heavy wind? You know, they break, right? So you're now setting yourself up for worse injury. You can get away with doing that kind of thing for maybe 10 years. And all of a sudden, maybe you have PTSD because you've had so many near-death experiences. Maybe you're burnt out on your sport because you're so exhausted of not dealing with the fear. Some people may start to have panic attacks because they're not dealing with the fear. Depression, a lot of anxiety. Again, eventually it gets to the point where you can't handle this anymore, right? For me, I started to hate my sport. I had injuries that wouldn't heal. That's just a bad route and it makes you a rigid person. Instead, what I would do today is I would stand up there and I would notice that I feel discomfort in my body and I'd close my eyes and I'd spend a moment identifying where it is, like, okay, it's in my chest. And then I would say, oh, well, it's perfectly natural. Of course, I'm feeling afraid. This is a very scary situation. And I would just, I mean, that's a huge realization. Like, of course, I'm supposed to be feeling this fear. It's not a personal flaw. And spend 15 seconds feeling that. And then I would notice if it's in excess, you know, like I've done this a million times. If it seems excessive, that means that I haven't been dealing with my fear and in an honest way. And so I would spend a moment just noticing like, oh, sorry, fear, I've been repressing you. Let me make it up to you. And then I would allow myself to feel it. And that's the third step. So the first step is acknowledge it's natural. Second step is get to know your relationship with that fear. And is it the healthiest relationship possible? The third thing, and I know I've been talking for a while, but this is such an important point. So thinking about fear is not honoring fear. Then you're just in your head, right? Feeling fear is what we're going for. And so next thing you know, I'm feeling my fear. It's in my chest. And I'm not feeling it as a way to get rid of it. I'm just honoring it by allowing it its rightful place in my life. And what happens is that process organically takes me into my body. And then when I become intimate with the fear, because like you know, if you're feeling your girlfriend, right? Like if you, that's kind of the precursor to an intimate relationship with your girlfriend. Like if I'm having that kind of physically embodied experience with fear, it naturally leads to intimacy. And next thing you know, I come alive with that fear. It's like the percolation of fear. It's like next thing you know, I'm more sharp. I'm more focused. I'm totally in the present moment. I am, you know, Kristen plus fear equals super Kristen, right? Yeah. And then I push off and fear is kind of the thing that's making me more powerful, more wise, and just really crystal clear on, it's like the creativity that comes from that too. It's so powerful. And I facilitate people and people doing a dance with fear down the mountain. And I swear to God, their skiing improves by about 40% in an instant, in a shift in that intimacy with fear relationship, doing a dance with it. It's magical.
Wow. That is a hell of a cognitive rampage right there, Chris. And that's what we call that. The idea is to talk you into right to that rampage. That was beautiful. I could see the mountain and the difference. And, you know, we really do. I gave a speech with ESPN and some NFL football players were doing this competing. And I talked about the power of the belief and when you accept certain ideas. But I told a story that got famous for a while about a woman that was caught on video in a couple pictures lifting up the quarter front end of her Volkswagen Beetle to pull her six-year-old to safety. And I talk about the amazing things that we can do biologically when there was no thought. And I said, do you think for a moment the mom said, can I lift this up? She just lifted that up. And in that moment where you see it, we do become that superhero that you spoke about. When we zap into the fear, when you utilize it, when you apply it and use that part of being human, it's why Bambi gets away from the sneaky, you know, cheetah or lion or land, you know, the lion that's trying to get it. It gets away more times than it gets caught, you know, and so unless fear sneaks up on it, right? Other than that, a lot of the times it wins and it's utilizing, like you said, all of its capabilities. And I think, you know, you're in the flow state too with Stephen Kotler and these guys and Jamie Wheel, how they're learning more that our brain tends to shut off when we go into that flow state or that fight or flight mode. I'm a freestylist myself. I love to freestyle poetry. I love to do it all the time. And I'll just go for hours sometimes and my brain shuts off. And I always feel the fear in the beginning when I start, the heart starts racing, you feel the adrenaline like, oh, and then you catch that wave, you know, you get on that wave and you do really, you ride the fear almost.
Right. And when you heard me describe what it was like to be intimate with fear, it's like all of a sudden I really couldn't describe it. It's really beyond our rational ability.
Just like we say about love. Just like we say about love. We sit there, we have the same face. We're going, I don't know. They're just, right? That's, we describe love the same way. We get lost in it and there's no words, which is again why I think we fall in fear, not love.
Right. And, you know, extreme sports are notorious for taking people into the zone. And we think that we get there despite the fear. No, we get there because of the fear.
Wow. You hear the commentators, right? Oh, Kristen has no fear. She is just going over that third ramp. She took that last jump like, man, that was just professional. I'm sorry. I'm doing the weird radio guy announcer voice. But that's, no one really talks like that in life, right? Imagine if you met me. I was like, hi, Kristen, how are you? You're making a great day today. But they even say it, right? The announcers, right? They even go, oh, they just are fearless. They're just jumping down the mountain, right? Fearless. And you're the X game leader, basically, person for 12 years going, no, gentlemen, that's not what we're doing.
Right. And it's totally disrespectful to fear. Like we are unanimously not acknowledging the fact that fear is actually the thing that is one of the most amazing experiences we have here on planet Earth. It brings us alive and little else does. Fear makes us strong. It makes us wise. It keeps us safe. We all know that. It helps us see clearly. It provides us with energy. It's what takes us into a state of awareness and motivation. I mean, I felt like I was fearless during my ski career. Make no mistake, I wasn't. Fear of looking like an idiot, fear of not being special, fear of not being loved motivated me. It's the fear is, I mentioned about the vulnerability, kind of vulnerability is kind of the core of the beauty of what it means to be a human being. And, you know, fear and vulnerability are so intimately tied. If you're unwilling to feel fear, you're never willing to feel vulnerable, and you miss the whole point of being a human being, which is to allow ourselves this vulnerability, especially with another person. And if you have, let's look at fear of failure, right? People say, oh, fear of failure holds me back. But for other people, like for me, for Bill Gates, probably for you, fear of failure actually motivates you. You know, it gets me off the couch. I don't want to fail. I'm going to work twice as hard so that I don't fail, right? What's the difference? The difference is the way that we react to fear. If we're willing to bring fear into the creative process and we're willing to kind of merge with our fear of failure, it motivates us. But if we're trying to ignore it or avoid it and lock it in the basement and I don't want to have anything to do with this, right? It then kind of holds us back. So the person that's sitting on the couch, not doing anything with their life, they're avoiding fear. That's all they're doing. They're not using the fear to help them come alive and get off the couch and do great things.
Yeah. Fear. I was having a thought when we were talking about all the things that fear does, how it motivates us, you know, and brings us together. I couldn't help but think about September 11th actually went through my head and what we did as a country, how we all pulled together. It was this, and because of fear. And in the same token, I also think about how much fear propaganda is pushed to us to keep us afraid, you know, to keep us divided, to keep us not paying attention as a society, as a whole, maybe even as a globe. In that double-edged sword about it, right? When the fear attacks us in our backyard or in any way in your life, in your community, your family, it tends to bring a community together a lot of the times. But sometimes it also seems like that double-edged sword. That's what was going through my mind is how, but it's the way it's used. I could almost hear you ringing in my head going, no, it's the way the fear is used. You know, the separation, the way fear is used to keep us quiet, divided and on the couch, or when fear happens to us and we come together as a community.
It's the same thing with all the emotions, the negative emotions. Let's take sadness, for example. Like, think of a pianist. I heard a story about a woman pianist whose mother died 10 minutes before a performance. And the assistant found out, and the assistant had to decide, do I tell the woman before or after her performance? Well, in the creative arts, we know that the emotions are the most important part of the creative process. So the assistant told the woman before, 10 minutes before she was going to perform. How do you think she performed?
Best ever.
Right. And nobody in the audience knew that the woman's mother had just died, but there wasn't a dry eye in the audience. They were so moved by her performance that was birthed from sadness, like super creative. Like, sadness is the birthplace of human compassion and caring. So I'm a PR director for sadness too. Anger. You know, there'd still be slavery if it weren't for anger. Like, anger rights wrongs. You know, it's supposed to ramp us up to, like, not put up with something that is just wrong about in our lives. Of course, the only version of anger we know is, you know, people getting punched and road rage and right. People getting thrown out of the window. Well, that's undealt with fear from the basement. But anger in its honest kind of creative form rights wrongs. It's same with fear. You know, like, we don't then become fearless. We use the fear to help us come alive and be more focused and like allow fear the freedom to have its rightful place in your life. And then all of a sudden you feel free and you're just so motivated to affect change, all of that. I don't think that ISIS or people that are trying to impose terror on America or the West really get that. Yes, they're trying to control us with fear, but the people that have an honest, healthy relationship with fear, it's only going to make them come alive. But the people that have a repressive, dishonest relationship with fear, it's going to cripple them and hold them back.
I love the approach. I love it. I love the approach and coming from somebody that's experienced everything you have. I think you stand at the top of the mountain to be able to talk about what fear is and how it can help us and change us. I love the approach because it's not confrontational, and a passive aggressive way to fight fear, like, is how we started, is walking through the dialogue of it, doing some reframing, some mindfulness practice, right? But we're not then utilizing our full self. We're that 60% person who's not using all of our senses to be able to make choices and move. Because, man, when you put a human in a survival situation, we're amazing little cockroaches, man. We survive. we find a way. We really do that. And I love to say that uncomfortable is where the change is, and you have to put yourself, you can create those experiences by making yourself uncomfortable daily, by putting you, making choices that put you in those situations that get you to face those fears. But then I love the idea of not just facing them, but making friends with them, utilizing them, bring them into your life. Tapping into it. This is beautiful. I'm going to share your book with all my MMA guys, the real idea. Cause I want to tell these MMA guys to think they're tough. I'm gonna like, why don't you go on top of that triple black diamond and jump out of a helicopter? And you tell me if there's no fear there. But really helping with the idea to embrace it and to use it and not to fight, suppress, or any of those combative ways with it.
Anytime you want to expand who you are as a person, go out and do something that scares you. It's the only thing that it's part of the equation, and it's the only thing that's going to help you grow. You have to do something out of your comfort zone. Like if this is your comfort zone, you know, there's little fear in here. Every time you step out of your comfort zone, there's going to be fear. You know, you have to take a risk, but then you do it enough, connect the dots. This is your new comfort zone. Next thing you know, you've expanded who you are. And I kind of want this to be a tipping point too in our conversation, where we're talking about how repressing fear is bad. It's what almost everybody teaches some form of it. I'm the only one that goes as far down the rabbit hole as like, you want to honor fear. Some people say you need to accept it, but that's, you know, that reeks of it is what it is and there's nothing I can do about it. And it's like, right. Like I go all the way with like, you need to honor it. And I want to kind of give you, the audience, everybody out there, some practical tips on how to do that. Because if you've been repressing fear your whole life, you know, you're very invested in that experience and you probably don't even know how to get out of that unconscious habitual pattern. Talk to me about your relationship with fear. Like, talk to me like I'm your fear. And maybe everybody that's listening can do this. Like, how do you speak to fear? Like, I like to personify fear. I'm your fear. So talk to me in terms of you, not it, but like, you suck. I both like you, but I hate you. Like, talk to me right now.
Oh, I tend to be a lot in my head, actually. This is a fun experiment for myself. If I was talking my fear, which I do a lot,
I'm your fear.
Yeah. Well, good to see you again. And I'm still scared to death of you. You made a couple choices over in your life that I'm not sure praying's going to help you out with much. And every time you show up, I tend to find myself in situations that I absolutely love, but for some reason I can't sit still for longer than 3 minutes and I have to continue moving all the time. And I've known you since I was probably about 6 and the first time I saw some abuse and was, I guess, introduced to you through abuse. And I met you not from just simply being a scared kid as I got older, but I met you from being in fear of people that were supposed to love me. And so when we first met, I was in a bad place already. And so you've technically been around every time I've been in a bad place. And anytime I start to use you, well, I tend to do bad things. And a lot of times lately, that changed. I changed the way I looked at you. Since I changed the way I looked at you and started using you a little bit more to say, fine, I dare you to, about writing a book or becoming a mental health counselor or leaving everything behind more than once in your life and just roaming the earth for a bit, you've been quite useful to me. So I appreciate you. And I hope you stick around a little bit more because we got a lot of shit to do still.
So that's pretty good, you know? Like, I find it interesting that you associated me with negative experiences. Like, the fact that you turned the corner with me, I'm speaking as fear, and that now we have kind of a more intimate relationship, like you appreciate me more.
No, I still hate you. I still hate you because some of the anxiety and shit I've been feeling like the last 6 months, I'm through the tunnel, if you will. I'm out of the woods, but it was difficult to face you, to be honest. So I still think about you from time to time when my heart races and I start sweating and I get a little dizzy sometimes. So I was trying to be half funny, but when you do show up sometimes, man, maybe a warning, send a letter, send me a text before you show up at the door. Maybe, let me know when you're going to come. I don't know. So I can plan for it. I don't know. Email at least, do something.
So everyone has the dialogue with fear that is unique to them. 7.5 billion different people, 7.5 different relationships between them and their fear. And so one of the key points that I'm trying to make in how to have a better relationship with fear is awareness is power. It used to be said that knowledge is power. What's more true in today's world is awareness is power. Like, become aware of your relationship with fear. Like, is it a combative one? Do you hate fear and thus you hate yourself? Do you repress it and put it in the basement and not deal with it? Thus, you're not dealing with your life. You're living a lie. Do you not do anything that would result in fear, which is a way of fleeing fear? You know, do you freeze in the face of fear? You know, fear is not causing you to freeze. You're freezing when fear's around, like, okay, if I don't move and I don't breathe, then maybe it'll go away, right? Fear finds that to be quite ridiculous, right? All of these crazy reactions to fear, like fear shows up in your life and all it does is say boo and you're like, ah, you know, you may be a drama queen, right, about it. So just notice your relationship with fear.
Perhaps it's an addiction for me, because I generally say things like, if I find I'm afraid of something, I have to go do it. Like, I'll be in conversation, I'll say, yeah, I was afraid to do this. I'm like, that means I'm gonna have to go do it now. Like, I don't want to. I don't want to do it, but now I have to because it made me afraid and it made my heart jump a little bit. So I can't have that. So I'm going to have to go do that once now.
So if you were a boyfriend and fear is your girlfriend, you're like, hey, let's hang out. Right.
Yeah.
And like, oh God, you again, you know, so it's a little,
yeah.
What's the word?
I'm a walking conundrum, man. I say I'm a rational romantic at the same time, which makes absolutely no sense. You know, I'm a cognitive practitioner with a strong spirit. You know, I do functional patterns and I used to play football and I love fight. I don't know. I think I'm just a walking conundrum in a way, but it's honestly, the conversation has really helped me take a different view on it though, Kristen. It really has of looking at the idea, because, you know, just over recently, it was hard for me, right? Being the cognitive rampage mental health guy, right? Being the guy who talks to you about depression diagnosis, being that dude, I was not allowed to be anxious. I was not allowed to feel anxiety, right? So as I am to myself, this was my own conscious belief, right? So as I was making probably the hardest transition of my life ever, not just harder than I think my first 2 year walkabout when I left the dope world, the nightclub game, when I left all that back when I was 26, this most recent transition has been more difficult than that on me. And it started in March or February. And I was having feelings of anxiety that everything I've studied and known and helped everybody out with, here I am experiencing it. And I'm in this utter denial that this is actually happening. I'm literally going, this doesn't happen. Are you kidding? I will cognitively rampage it out away from my life. This is not the guy. And so until I really pulled the awareness, like you said, made it a thing, not who I was, but made it something that I was experiencing, faced it, if you will, but then allowed it to flow through me. I kind of found myself coming out of the woods, purging is what I called it. When I cry, when I felt like it, you know, I would do something, just allow those emotions to flow through me. And I found myself coming out of the woods, and I have been over the last month or two, and it's great. But the conversation here, I think about those fearful moments when there was a serious contemplation of going to the hospital, you know, again, of going, is this a heart attack, right? Am I dying? Are those real impending doom thoughts, and how I approached it. Approaching it the way every psychologist and cognitive guy would tell you, which is reframing the moment, being mindful, but I'm making it worse because I'm now being mindful of how shitty it is in the moment. And I'm going, well, this is shitty, instead of trying to combat it and embrace it and bring it to me and walk through it almost in a purge way, but allowing it. And that conversation with you, Kristen, is making me take that different look at it, but possibly wishing, man, where was your book when I 6 months ago when I, you know, want to run into this idea? But I love that approach and gives me a different look on looking at fear altogether. You're really making me take a backwards look at all of my life up to now, going, how much really did, and how much am I putting down, right? To really ask myself the questions. And I think a lot of that is an important part of what you're saying, is being willing to ask ourselves those questions. What are we afraid of? Why am I afraid of fear? You know, how can I bring it into my life and not let it control my life?
This book is definitely a major game changer, and you can see how complicated people's relationship is with fear. I mean, look at you. It's like you have this very complicated, like, I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about that, I'm bouncing around. And, you know, really, fear is very, very simple. It's just a sensation of discomfort in your body. It's neither good nor bad. It's uncomfortable, right? But then our thinking mind and our judging mind just sees it as bad. And then we make it the problem. And, you know, things get really crazy from there. And so if you have an honest relationship with fear, that's why I say thinking about fear is not going to give you an honest relationship with it. Talking about fear with your therapist is not going to help you at all, right? Talking and thinking about it. You've got to deal with fear, not intellectually. You know, like don't deal with an emotional problem intellectually. You deal with an emotional problem emotionally. And how you do that, because emotions are sensations in the body, is you allow yourself to feel them. And it becomes really, really simple. So you talked about flow. And we love Stephen and Jamie and the Stealing Fire guys, right? So this is my definition of flow, and it's in the book. But the traditional number in Zen practice, I've studied with a Zen master for 15 years to heal my relationship with fear and write this book. But imagine, and 10,000 is the traditional number in Zen, you have a hose. When we think of flow, we think of water, right? Here's 10,000 states of being coming through your hose like water droplets. And your body is the hose, of course. And here comes an emotion like sadness. Here comes anger. Here comes fear. Here comes frustration. Here comes joy. Here comes love. Here comes thoughts. You know, here comes judgment. And when we're in flow, you know, they come into, through, and out of our lives. It's actually been studied by science in about 10 to 90 seconds. Like fear shows up, you feel it. And if you are in flow with it, it's gone in about 10 to 90 seconds. But if it shows up and you wish it weren't so, or you start to think about it or judge it, or you start to try to control it, all of a sudden the hose becomes kinked. You know, all your resources just go to, you know, pushing it down, right? And all of a sudden you're not in flow with your life anymore. You have no chance of getting into the higher altered states that are depicted in Stealing Fire. You have no chance of being in the zone, you know, in sports. And you're just now stuck in the cycle of managing that fear, which turns into anxiety, which turns into panic attacks, which turns into depression, which turns into PTSD, you know, and on and on and on, until your life becomes all about managing that undealt with emotion. And you could do this for 10 years, 50 years, your whole life. And that's no life. But if we're in flow, if we allow these uncomfortable sensations, fear, sadness, anger, its rightful place in our host, like into, through, and out of our lives, if we deal with them on a daily basis, honestly, then we're constantly in flow. And this is really interesting. Like with PTSD, when I work with clients with PTSD, you don't have to go back in time to 20 years ago and relive the incident. You know, that's in the past. The only thing you have to do is just notice your relationship with fear as it exists today, unrelated to the story, unrelated to the incident, make friends with it, and kind of open up the hose, unkink the hose. And then all of a sudden, it's like a miracle. Like in just a few hours of sessions, they're no longer stuck in that pattern anymore. Depression's gone. PTSD is gone. Certainly panic attacks are gone. This work is remarkably fast at solving problems. And then you're now set up, you're in a state of freedom. You know, you're headed towards whole mind thinking. You're now in flow with your life and anything becomes possible from there.
I think that's cognitive rampage number two. Chris, I think you're getting yourself in flow state a few times on here. The flows, and I think about too, as I said it before, I love freestyle and just doing spoken word poetry, etc. And I tell anybody that you can do it, that anybody can do freestyle poetry, and just they can. And I've been doing it a long time. And I don't write well, but I think about when I talk to those people and how to do it. I walk them through of going, letting yourself go. I tell you to think of a story that you could tell by talking about the pictures, what temperature it was, what shirt you were wearing, all the details of the story, and tell me that story just talking to me as you're telling me the story. And don't worry about whether you rap or not. And that story itself will start to pull you into a flow state almost, and keep your eyes closed so you don't observe anything else, because whatever you see, you'll start to want to rap and talk about. But as you're telling that story, start to talk about how it made you feel, and then just go into it. And as people start talking about about it. Next thing you know, you're not worried about rhyming. You're just spitting and you're already in flow. You're talking at the end of the show, just like I did with Steven once before. At the end of each time, I would go into some rhyme just like this, start talking. Next thing you know, I was spitting something that was poetically lyric. But here I am now doing it again. You walk yourself right into flow. Kristen, thank you for coming on the show.
Wow, that was beautiful.
but anyone can do it, right? You can just tell that story. And as you relate to a story, you start telling the story, then the emotions come from, like right now, the emotion of fear is in me. My heart is racing like crazy. If you can see my hand, it has a little shake. That adrenaline starts to go through and it just really shuts that mind off. And you really feel it turn off. And that's really what you're saying, I think, is allowing it to flow through you. Use that with it and let it propel you for anything you choose. I think I just rhymed again on accident.
Yeah, you basically have two choices. And there are a lot of books out there that'll teach you how to overcome or conquer fear or push it away or rationalize it. You know, emotional intelligence is considered our ability to understand our emotions and control them. I mean, that's crazy. That's not what we're supposed to be doing with our emotions. I just loved how you went into your body and just and let that percolation, that it's like our emotions are our gas in our tank, you know, and have it come out in a creative way. Like, we get that the emotions are more important than technique or anything in singing and in poetry slamming and even sports performance. And so there are two choices. My book offers a completely different path. The first choice is, of course, block it out. It becomes an intensive effort. You get temporary relief from the fear. It actually causes worse fear over time because it backs up. It becomes harder and harder to do. You bring it home with you. You throw it at your wife or you start to burn out. It causes disorders, insomnia. Or you can do what I suggest, which is turn towards it and have an honest relationship with it. And of course, take it out of the basement. Make friends with it, not just mere acceptance, and then use it as a tool for creativity, like I just saw you do, like a lot of athletes do. You know, the choice is yours. Two choices. One kind of is a dead end that, you know, is going to really mess up your life, and the other choice will help you come alive. So good luck.
That is beautiful. I appreciate it, Kristen. Thanks again for coming on the show. And anytime you want to come back, you're more than welcome. The mic is open to you. So when you write your next book, feel free to come. Yeah, face the fear. You may have to do that again. It hurts like heck, but you may have to do that again, especially.
I love fear. I love feeling. It's my thing, right? And I still repress it. It takes me less time to notice that I'm repressing it, though.
Oh, well, thanks again. Thank you for sharing the tips and the knowledge and your experience with everybody. That's what this show's all about, is about learning from other people's experience, gaining their competence and downloading that and letting it flow through us and applying that and sharing it with other people. So I hope everybody listening shares Kristen's book, buy her book. It's on Amazon right now. Or you can also check out our website where you can get it. It's just her name, KristenUlmer.com. Look her up. Same names on the internet and Facebook, right?
Yes. If you go through my website to buy the book, you get a gift. But yes, please buy my book for your friends too. Like, if somebody has depression or panic attacks or anxiety disorders or PTSD, like, this is the missing link. This will explain everything. It doesn't just address the symptoms. It actually addresses the cause, and it has a lot of really, really practical advice that can change lives. So please buy it for your friends as well.
I appreciate it, Kristen. Thanks a lot. And anytime you want to come back on, or let me know you want to come on and share something, and we'll rampage together.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.